Okay, let's see if that worked. Yes, okay, it seems that the transcriber is on too, which is perfect timing for my next bullet point, which is about call notes. We do keep meeting minutes and audio recordings of these calls for posterity, and so that you can go back and listen if you're not able to attend. So many great topics, so many things that are rapidly evolving and developing in this community that we really want to have that historical archive. So we do that. And if you are interested in contributing to the conversation, which I hope every one of you will, I invite you to put yourself on the queue with Q Plus. That will allow you to, that will allow me to be able to manage that queue and call on you to be able to participate. If you want to remove yourself from the queue, you just put Q minus. And now is the time of our call where we have the opportunity to have introductions and reintroductions. So I would invite anyone who is new to the community to tell us a little bit, put yourself on the queue with Q Plus and tell us a little bit about yourself and your work and your interest in this community. And if you haven't been here for a while and you want to do a reintroduction and let us know what you've been up to, we definitely would love to hear that as well. So do I have anyone for introductions and reintroductions? All right. Well, we have a healthy group today. So if you are not comfortable introducing yourself and you want to just type that in the queue and let folks know you're here, you're certainly welcome to do that as well. And then the next section of our agenda is announcements and reminders. So do I have anyone want to put themselves on the queue with something they want to share with the group today?
I'll just kind of preview the upcoming agenda. So the next meeting we'll have Andrew to talk about mobile driver license and what's new, the latest changes in MDL. And the meeting after that, we'll have Manu to talk about true age. As a lot of you guys know, California just launched their wallet pilot program that's built by Spruce. And then in addition to that, it also includes the true age selected disclosure kind of verification mechanism. So Manu will talk about that. And then the meeting after that will be having Daniel to talk about the latest in Open Wallet Foundation. And after that, we'll have Sophia to actually talk about the DID technologies in healthcare. So that's the upcoming meetings that we have for the next four meetings.
That sounds like really interesting topics. Again, I think after IIW, I know I'm feeling like there are so many interesting things happening and just this momentum in this community is very exciting. Any other announcements and reminders? Anyone have anything that they want to share around work items? All right. Well, Justin, we have a very large but quiet group this morning. So hopefully you will, you'll wake them up and get them buzzing when we come to the time for community discussion. But without further ado, I will go ahead and turn it over to you and let you educate us about GNAP. Did I say that right? I guess that's the first thing I need to know. Or is it GNAP?
Thank you. So yeah, that's actually a question I get asked a lot is how are you supposed to pronounce this? I personally say GNAP with a hard G, but there is no official pronunciation. There was actually a big debate in the working group about whether or not there should be, but, you know, having worked on a number of, other technologies myself in, including, including this token format that is spelled JWT, and is ostensibly pronounced JWT, and it says so right in the spec that that's how you're supposed to pronounce it, but I've heard JWATs and JWTs and lots of variations on that in the wild. So I've long since given up trying to have really any hold on an official pronunciation. So GNAP is fine. I don't care. I've heard GNAP and NAP with just a soft G, like, you know, like new. And, you know, it ultimately, I don't think it matters all that much. So hello, everybody. Thanks for inviting me out to this. And I am going to talk today about GNAP, which is a protocol that is currently in development at the IETF. We're going to see if screen sharing actually works here. Just give us one sec.
All right. It will work best if you are not on Safari.
What was that? Sorry?
It will work best if you are not on Safari as your browser. Any other browser but Safari.
That is incorrect. Firefox is also not so great with the Jitsi tool. So I had to switch to Chrome today for this, okay. Even though I don't really care for it.
You knew it better than I did.
But thank you for the heads up. So it looks like I'm sharing out my screen. I'm going to load up a presentation that I have, just because it has a few main talking points. I will say when I have this up, I cannot see the queue. So I ask that the chairs, please feel free to interrupt me if there's something on the queue that, that people want to bring forward.
Sounds good.
And, so this is a set of slides about, that I've had in my pocket for a bit. This is not something that, I prepared specifically for today, which just means that we're going to be bouncing around through this presentation a bit, and hitting the topics that this group finds most interesting. So first off, we talked about the name a little bit, and GNAP is also what Smurfs say when they are bitten by the purple fly and they run around biting other Smurfs on the butt. And it's actually part of the origins of the modern communicable zombie disease myth that debuted in Les Tronfs comic book years before Night of the Living Dead was actually done. This is not the intentional origin of this, but it turns out it's hard to agree on naming things, and so we have GNAP. For those of you familiar with OAuth 2, this is not an extension or application of OAuth 2 itself. It's not intended to be wire compatible with OAuth 2, and that is a deliberate design decision. We'll see the reasons for that in just a little bit. This was meant to be an exercise of, you know, starting with what we've learned from OAuth 2, where can we go from there? It's also important for me to say that this is not OAuth 3, although it gets called that from time to time. The OAuth working group, for better or worse, controls the OAuth branding within the IETF community. And the OAuth working group has decided to, at least at this time, not do anything called OAuth 3. That said, GNAP is really built on a lot of what we've seen in OAuth 2 over the years, which includes a whole ton of extensions and adaptations and lots of stuff that needs to work within side of OAuth 2's limitations. And some of the stuff that we're seeing now, like the, self-issued, offering party in OpenID Connect, or pushed authorization requests, or things like that, really don't really look like OAuth anymore. But there's some stretched claims you can make about them being compatible with the general model of OAuth. What we decided to do with GNAP is really move beyond that, because, you know, OAuth's not going anywhere, but we definitely had a lot of limits that we've reached over the years. So we wanted to ask the question, if we were building all the stuff that we're doing in OAuth today and got a chance to address a bunch of the things that OAuth really doesn't do very well, what would that even look like? So we decided to actually build something brand new. Instead of building on top of OAuth 2 or trying to extend it, we decided to take those concepts and start with a new protocol with some key design pillars. First off, unlike OAuth 2, which is really a suite of related protocols, we really wanted this to be a single protocol with very clear extension points that's all about negotiating delegated access. So you've got two pieces of software that are talking to each other in order to allow one to get access to the other. We wanted to be extensible in how we interact with humans. We wanted to have a bunch of different ways of dealing with the different kinds of client software that's out there. Very importantly, OAuth 2 was built, at least initially, around this assumption of bearer secrets everywhere, both bearer tokens and client secrets, and a lot of the OAuth world is now struggling to move past that. So we wanted to start Gnap in the space where we're already looking at keys. And we wanted to have a better model of how to request stuff and kind of what that looks like. All right. So Gnap at its core is all about negotiating access. So OAuth you may have heard called a delegation protocol, or you may have heard it called an authorization protocol, where in fact it is a delegation protocol. What you're doing in OAuth is you're delegating a right of access that somebody, probably a person, has to a piece of software. And Gnap at its core is really about that. But we wanted to have this work in a way that it's about a conversation where you have a grant that moves through a bunch of different states as things actually continue. So a request can come in to a Gnap authorization server, and then it gets to decide, well, do I need to interact with the user or not? And then while I'm waiting for the user to interact, I can end up in this pending approval state, and eventually I can get you the access token, which I can then later revoke. This is a model that is not really new. This exists in the OAuth world, but it's kind of hidden in the OAuth community, in the OAuth protocols. You'll see this same kind of pattern baked into software without people really realizing that it's there. And so with Gnap, we really set to put that entire negotiation front and center. And the way that that works is that the client shows up and it has a request that has a bunch of different parts in it. It includes, hey, these are all the APIs that I want to access and the kinds of things that I want to do there. And by the way, if you need to interact with the user, here's my list of ways to do that. And by the way, here's also a bunch of information about me, the client software. I can prove that I have access to a set of keys. I can give you identifiers. I can give you attestations about my platform, whatever you need. And then also, interestingly, we wanted to bring user information right to the front and center of Gnap. Because as I'm sure most of the group already knows, one of the biggest applications of OAuth 2 out in the world today, at least the interoperable applications of OAuth 2, is OpenID Connect. And OpenID Connect is an identity protocol that's built on top of OAuth by allowing you to delegate authorization to know who the user is right now. And so with Gnap, we wanted to make that kind of thing a first-class citizen by looking at the ways that people were using OpenID Connect and building those core functions into the protocol. Now, to make it a fully featured identity protocol with schemas and provisioning and all of that other stuff, you would still have to add more onto it. But the goal was to have that delta be much, much, much smaller between Gnap and a full identity protocol than what OAuth was with OpenID Connect. So a Gnap request is a JSON object that gets sent as an HTTP post. Now, this is an important part of the protocol to mention here. In OAuth 2, we've got a lot of different ways that we can interact with the user. In fact, one of the first things that I tell people when looking at OAuth, I'm going to jump ahead here for a bit, is, which grant type are you using? Which flow are you using? this is a flowchart from my book, OAuth 2 in Action, that we spend considerable number of pages walking people through this decision tree to figure out which grant type you need to use in OAuth. And one of the reasons that this is important is that in OAuth, each of these is started in a completely different way. The implicit flow starts with a redirect. The device flow is a post to a backend. The client credentials and assertion are a post to the token endpoint. And this means that every time that you start something in OAuth, you need to already know where you're going to go next and how that's going to work in order for you to even start the OAuth conversation. In GNAP, we didn't want that. We wanted it to be a negotiation. We wanted it to be a transaction. So every single request in GNAP starts with an HTTP post to the same endpoint, to the only defined discoverable endpoint of the authorization server. And in this request, what we're doing, and I'm not sure if my cursor's coming through, but in the top section here, we're saying, I want an access token, and this is the list of things that I want to access. Here's information about the client. So right now, I'm just identifying it with an identifier string. And these are the ways that I can interact with the user. And the request starts out like that, and it can grow and change depending on what you want to do. Say you have a more complex API. OAuth has scopes. We have rich data structures. More on that later. Say you are registering a client for the first time. Well, in OAuth, you have to have a client ID. In GNAP, a client ID is an optional optimization for the cases where it makes sense. Really, the default in GNAP is that you present a public key, and then you present proof of that public key. And then the authorization server can figure out, like, oh, hey, have I seen this public key before? Do I have that associated with something that I can trust in some fashion? And then you go from there, which means that in GNAP, there is no dynamic registration endpoint because you can simply start the conversation and the AAS can figure out whether or not it's seen you before. That is a really, really powerful pattern to be able to allow these components to have these conversations. Because every single time I start off a request, I might not know where it's going next, but all of the parties are given the information that they need in order to make that next step decision. Speaking of which, the response that comes back is also a JSON object that has a bunch of different potential fields. Now, you can have, of course, access tokens that come back for calling APIs if those are already ready to be granted. If you need to interact with the user, well, then you can tell the client, oh, hey, here's how you kick off interaction with the user next. There's no discovering an authorization endpoint and sending stuff there and then being sent back and all this other stuff like that. If you can do redirects and things like that, which we'll see in a minute, then you declare that and it moves on from there. And this is definitely an interesting one to this group. If the client knows information about the user, let me go back to that request. If the client knows information about the user, the client can present that to the authorization server. And if the authorization server has information about the user, that can come back directly. Which is to say, if the client has, say, a verifiable presentation that it wants to submit to the AS for the AS to process, then you can do that. And that might be enough for the AS to be able to process the request without needing to get the user involved in a browser at all. This is a really, really powerful pattern that GNAP enables that is very much more difficult to pull off in OAuth. Now, to look a little bit at what the responses look like, this is one. Oh, yeah, there was one last section I forgot to talk about. But this is a response that says, I need you to get the user involved and then come check again. So in order to do that, we've got this interact section that in this case is saying, you said you could redirect the user to an arbitrary URL. I'm going to send you there, and this is a nonce we're going to use to get you back here. When all of that's done, in order to continue this grant request, here's all the information you need to do it. I'm going to give you an access token that is only good for calling this URL. And this URL and this access token value are completely at the control of the authorization server. And importantly, they are bound to, this request is bound to the same key that the client used when it made that first request. So these are not bearer tokens that you're seeing. They are all bound to the client's presentation key. So after we interact and we go through whatever steps we need to and we get the authorizations that we need to, we can send back access tokens, which is this first bit up here. So just like the access token used for the continuation request, it's the same data structure. We've got a token value, and in this case, a list of things that are granted for the client to be able to see. We've also here returned an opaque identifier for the end user, which we call subject information. And this uses another spec from the IETF called subject identifier formats. And that allows the AS to say to the client, oh, hey, yeah, you're talking to me over TLS. You know that it's coming from me. I'm just going to tell you the user ID. And you can trust that within this context. If we need assertions, we can talk about that also. But we found that in a lot of cases, OpenID Connect clients really are just getting the JOT and parsing it to get the identifier out of it. And as long as the fields line up, they're pretty happy with that because they're talking over TLS over the back channel. And that's honestly not that unreasonable. So what all of this means is that GNAP really is a protocol. The instance of client software makes its request. If it needs interaction, it goes and gets the user involved who then interacts with the authorization server. Once that finishes, we continue and we grant access. This is all facilitated using what we call the grant transaction API. So we always post to the AS to start, like I said. And importantly, there's only a single AS URL that the client needs to know at the start. So the client just makes its request. It's going to use its keys and whatever proof methods are tied to that. And if the client has a set of, means of interacting with the end user, we can start negotiating what the next steps will be from there. And then, this continuation response allows us to say, hey, you're going to call this API and then you're going to use this access token. Now, an interesting thing about this is that one of the things we looked at in GNAP, when designing GNAP was, what are the things that have been kind of, you know, baked into OAuth 2 that were really, really kind of overfit to the purpose? One of the things that we found was refresh tokens. Refresh tokens are both underspecified in that they're always bearer tokens, but they're always tied to the client credentials if the credentials exist, and it's all kind of ambiguous how you do that with extensions like Depop and the like. Or MTLS, but at the same time, they're very specifically for when the access token isn't good anymore, use this to go get a new access token. Except sometimes you can still use it when the access token is still good. And sometimes that means you get a new token. Sometimes that means sometimes you get the same token. And sometimes that token gets replaced on you. So there's a lot of sometimes that happen with this. So with GNAP, what we realized is that this whole negotiation process, this multi-stage process, was really just managing this grant life cycle over time, right? The client is saying, it's making one call to say, start this off, and then it's being handed a resource that it can then manage over time. And that management can be, oh, I got a call back from the front channel that interaction is completed. You know, here's the nonce calculations that you need in order to validate that, and let's go. And sometimes that can be, the tokens that I was using for this previous grant request don't work anymore. Give me some new ones. And that can all happen through the same defined API, because then that allows the client and the AS to negotiate with each other about what's needed for each of those steps to happen. So the principle here is really all about simplicity for the client software. We want to use the same kind of access token to protect the GNAP API that we would at the RS. And we also want to use the same key binding methods. So that means that if the client is capable of calling the AS with a key binding method for that initial request, then the client's already proved that it's capable of making that request, and we can rely on that ability when we allow the client to call the continuation API. So we just bind the access token to that same presentation method, and we're good to go. So the next major pillar is all about interaction. Like I mentioned before, OAuth2 is one of the first things about OAuth2 is figuring out which grant type you're going to do. But in GNAP, like we talked about, we always start with an HTTP post. And then the AS gets to process and respond to that. Well, the way that turns out is that with a GNAP grant request, one of the things that it can do is say, like, hey, this is the list of things that I can do in order to interact with whatever user is using me. If you've got an arbitrary URL, I can get them to it somehow. Maybe I'll redirect them. Maybe I'll put a QR code on the screen. I don't know. And hey, if there's some user code that they can type in that's somewhere else, then I can do that. I can display that. And I can know a certain number of extensions and whatnot. Oh, and by the way, when you're done with interacting with the user, here's how to let me know. So whether that's a redirect or a push or some other mechanism that comes through in an extension. What the AS does is it looks through all of that and it says, all right, for the thing that you're requesting, this is what's appropriate. Maybe because I don't trust multi-device flows, I'm not going to allow you to do a user code type in. I'm going to expect you to go to a specific URL or use this extension that we've agreed on. We actually work. So the Open Payments Group in Europe has the Secure Payments Processor. Yes, I forget the acronym. But it's basically a web authent extension that they have a GNAP wrapper for, so that the client can say, hey, I can do this secure payments thing. And the AS can come back with, oh, great. Prompt the user with these parameters for secure payments and send it to this endpoint. And then that's how interaction happens. So we're no longer bound to this model of we assume that the user is always in a browser. But when the user is in a browser, we can use that. So the client instance says what it can do, but the AS gets to choose from that set. And importantly, if the AS decides that, hey, I don't actually need to interact with the end user that's over there, then I can just return the results. I can return access tokens and subject info and anything else. Now, why would an AS do that? Well, maybe the client's already approved. And I know that just by the nature of the client that's asking. And I've got a risk engine that tells me, yeah, this looks like the exact same thing that's happened before. No need to involve the user this time. Because it would just annoy them. Or maybe the client is presented an assertion from a trusted third party as part of that initial request. So the AS can say, yeah, for the thing that you're asking for, that assertion covers you and you're all set. And so basically the negotiation here allows the client and the AS to figure out how and when to get the user involved. Now, this particular use case came to us from a large internet provider who had been actually using a combination of the OAuth assertion flow and the authorization code flow in order to solve their use cases. What they were doing was that they would start with the assertion flow and then detect an error on that. So the client would start one flow, and if that didn't work, the client would start a whole new OAuth flow with the redirect and everything from the start. In Gnap, that can all be folded together because this notion of what happens next is part of the negotiation. Let's see here. And there we go. That was the next bit that I wanted to go to. So I'm going to pause real quick before I dive into the next section. But are there any questions before I do?
Harrison.
Yeah. So, Justin, is it fair to say like Gnap is basically a complete rethinking of OAuth 2? And then also, can you also kind of summarize like what are the big changes that you made? Because like, obviously you changed from the bearer tokens to this public key cryptography, and then you also talk about changing and simplifying the flows. Like it feels like there's a bunch of changes. Can you kind of summarize what are the top changes you made compared to OAuth 2?
This entire presentation is summarizing the top changes.
So it does feel like there are tons of changes then. Like what do you think are the most impactful?
Mm-hmm. That's what I'm showing. So the most impactful are going to be that list that I gave right at the very beginning. You know, negotiating access around intent registration and having that be a single protocol. Having the flexible structure for all of the interactions, which led to the proliferation of OAuth grant types, which are no longer needed. Working with different kinds of client software, which was the bit I was about to get into, and having key binding and robust data models be first-class citizens. So, I think with that, it probably makes sense for me to just continue.
Dimitri has a question real quick before you do.
Sure.
Thanks. My question is, given the flexibility of the protocol, would you be interested in, or are there already existing, a profile for, say, using NAP to request verifiable credentials and presentations, right? So basically, using NAP as an alternative to VCAPI, OID4, and DITCOM 2.
Yeah, absolutely. A bit, it was talked about in the VC group a while ago, but, it was dropped by that group. I'm not actively working on it, but it really is set up to allow for that kind of thing. Both, allowing the AS to accept here, I've actually got a picture of that, both allowing the AS to accept claims, from not only the end user, but also possibly a third party that's authorizing it. And then, basically distilling that into access tokens for API use. But also, as we saw, the Gnap response allows you to tell you information about the person that's there as well. So it's kind of its own issuance API, at the same time. So you could either get a token that allows you to mint whatever set of credentials using VCAPI that you need, which is one use case, or it could return the credentials directly, back into the client instance, which in this example that we're hand waving over would also be the wallet. Remember each of these boxes up here is a role played in the system and not necessarily a discrete device.
Makes sense. Thanks.
Yeah. Thank you. It's a great question. And I think that it actually, it fits really well into this kind of model. All right. Which actually brings us next, nicely into this notion of what is client software? So remember in the OAuth world, we started off with two web servers talking to each other. That was the use case that was being solved. Except that that kind of brought with it this notion that every piece of software would have a client ID. Now, some of them have a single instance per ID, like you've got a website and there's one copy of that website and it has a client ID. But sometimes you have something like a mobile application where all of the instances share a client ID, and or it's an SPA. And so you've got lots of completely disconnected instances that all have the same client ID. Now, sometimes those clients last a really long time and they only have a single user. This is the installed mobile app case. Some clients are ephemeral and only have a single user, which is like the SPA case. And some clients have an ID across many users, and this is back to the web server case. And there are variations on all of these. And yet, in OAuth 2, we require every single OAuth transaction to have a client ID. The reason for that turns out to be a side effect of assumptions that were made in the design of OAuth. OAuth 2 was designed around the authorization code grant type, and everything else was an optimization of that. And in the authorization code grant type, you start with a redirect in the browser. Now, the thing with a redirect in the browser is that because you're over the front channel, you can't have the client also sending a client secret, because then the secret's not a secret anymore. But you can at least identify the client and give the AS some chance of seeing that things are probably pointing to the correct client. And then you validate the client on the back end, and when the back channel calls come back, and use the client ID to tie it together. That's all well and good. But in GNAP, we took a look at this pattern and we realized the client ID really wasn't actually solving that problem the way that it seemed. So in GNAP, all client instances are identified by their keys. Some keys you create the first time you talk to the AS and it's never seen them before. Some of them are pre-registered. Some of them get issued to the client software by a trusted third party. That might be some type of PKI system or even a workload management system like Spiffy. Those keys get put into the software and it just uses it. But in the cases where you do have pre-registered keys that you can refer to, you can send the keys by value, but you could also send an identifier, but the identifier very specifically is defined to point back to the client's key. So even if a client has been issued an identifier, if it sends its public key by value, the AS is required to treat it exactly the same as if the client had sent its shorthand identifier, which allows you to have very, very, very dumb client software that doesn't know anything about these pre-registered instances. It just knows how to send keys, and that's fine. It covers all of the base case, covers all of the variations, and everything else, including a client identifier, is an optimization that's allowable for places that need it. This lets us actually keep bits of the OAuth, or bits of the underlying protocol from leaking, unlike OAuth. That is a principle that has allowed us to not have to define things like public clients and dynamic client registration and a lot of other things in the OAuth space that GNAP just doesn't need anymore. Which brings us to the topic of binding keys. Now, I mentioned before, OAuth is all about bearer secrets, where what you have, what you send, and what you verify are all the same. Proof of possession obviously works a bit differently. You have two parts of things. You send something that proves that you mixed it, and you verify using part of it. I'm hand-waving over decades of cryptography and related topics here. The important thing is that key proofs in GNAP are all based on the client being able to sign the message somehow. So the starting request, the continuation request, by default, all messages to the RS are also bound. And GNAP is flexible in how those signatures are actually calculated and presented. One of the most interesting ones, and oh wow, these slides are out of date. Sorry, we're up to draft, I think, 17 on this now, is HTTP message signatures. Now, HTTP message signatures is very imminently going to become an RFC. It's in the RFC editor's queue right now. So the spec itself is done. It is complete. It is finalized. It just needs to be cleaned up and published, which is the state that it's in right now. So we profiled how to use HTTP message signatures inside of GNAP. And we were able to do that by basically saying, all right, not only use HTTP SIG, but make sure you always sign these parts of the message, and this is how it ties to the keys and all of that other kind of stuff. Additionally, there are methods that are based on Jose. There are methods that are based on MTLS. Here we go. This is an example of a signed GNAP request. So we have a body down here that says, this is the access token that I want. This is my client information. And the two shades of orange here show us how the HTTP signature gets applied at the HTTP message. We actually sign the method, the target URI, the content type, the content digest, which protects the body here, and we send that off to the server for validation. By processing the signature, the AS can be sure that the key that's listed down here in the client section is the key that is used to sign the message. And we use the exact same process when we are calling the resource server. And here we have the authorization header, which is where the token actually gets put. The principle underlying all of this is to use HTTP. When we were starting GNAP, we had an opportunity to say, well, we could create an abstracted authorization delegation protocol that could be deployed across any number of systems or things like that. And we decided explicitly to not do that. We decided very explicitly to say, if we were going to do this, we want to use all of the power of HTTP. And then if GNAP needs to be deployed to protocols on top of protocols other than HTTP, well, then we would translate that. We would have a translation of GNAP onto some other system, because the underlying assumptions of what the platform gives you are going to be different. We saw that with OAuth and ACE, and working positively in that case. And we've seen the negative of this with large abstracted systems like, you know, WS Star. And if anybody remembers the soap and rest wars of the early aughts, you know, you'll know kind of what I'm talking about. So that gets us down to API access and sort of this data model. So in OAuth 1, you either had access to the API or you didn't. In OAuth 2, we invented this notion of scopes. Scopes are a great idea in that they ostensibly allow you to limit the access of the access token. It's no longer just, oh, hey, this user approved this, therefore it's anything that that user can do. It's like, oh, this user approved this for read-only, or this user approved this for just this one particular record. But in OAuth, we kind of found that scopes eventually fall short. So in GNAP, we built a rich set of multidimensional objects to allow people to describe what you want. The way that it works is that you have an array of objects, and each object has a type field, which tells you the kind of API that you're calling. That type field is basically sets up a definition for what the rest of the object can be. And we've created some reusable pieces like actions and locations and data types and things like that for the common dimensions that you find when you're talking to an API. But you don't have to use those in your API. And in fact, for example, this is an open payments charges request. So they did use the location. But then they have this limits object that is a bunch of financial information, that is only makes sense inside of their type object. Now, if you've been following OAuth recently, you might be thinking like, okay, this sounds a lot like RAR or rich authorization requests. Well, there's a good reason for that. RAR is the backport of GNAP's access request to fit on top of OAuth 2. And there's a lot of stuff in GNAP that's kind of happening that way. Now, when it's in OAuth 2, you have to deal with scope and resource and audience and a bunch of other parameters and make stuff make sense in sort of a larger scape. You need to do form encoding of JSON, which is super awkward, and the requests can get really big, which is a problem if you're doing authorization code grants, because that starts out in the browser where all of this goes, and that's the only place to put it. In GNAP, all of those problems kind of go away because it's built on this from the beginning. And one of the things that it actually gives you is the ability to make these aliases. So let's say I have an API where I have a really common thing that people ask for all the time. I don't want them to necessarily have to send the same structure every time. If there's no variables in this, then really I just want them to say, I want metadata access. So I can define this string metadata that means the same thing. Same thing with this update image. Now I'm not going and I'm not parsing update and then image and then applying it to write and image data, blah, blah, blah. It's like, no, I have a string that's defined that says, if you see this, it means this block. What that means is that I now have a data structure that can accommodate both RAR type objects and scope type strings, because this array can have objects and strings in it next to each other because JSON doesn't care. And when I do want to make a note to this particular crowd that when I say the type here, you notice that this is not an at context. There's no dollar schema or anything like that. There's no assumption that this is going to be an automated machine readable type of structure for systems to process. And GNAP does take a strong stance on that not being an assumption. Now, if you want that to be an optimization within your systems, sure, that's fine. GNAP doesn't say how to do that. GNAP just says that the AS needs to understand what that type means and how to map it to an access token. Because sometimes when you request something from a client, well, the AS is actually going to add additional fields. Like, for example, this case, it's a wallet identifier for the person that created this charges request. The client doesn't necessarily even need to know this identifier, but when the RS unpacks the token, it can go and see that. And the principle here is that we separate the knowledge out by different domains. Now, I could get into a whole bunch of advanced features at this point. You can request multiple access tokens in the same request and receive multiple access tokens. Potentially bound to different keys and presentations. There's a lot of fun stuff that you can do with GNAP. It's a really powerful, really flexible protocol. But at this point, I've been talking for about 40 minutes. So I am going to wrap it up, say thank you, and hopefully take any remaining questions.
Great. Thank you so much, Justin. This was really, really interesting. So I'm sold, but you don't have to sell me because I'm not going to be the one actually using it. But what I am curious about is, am I interacting with it? How is adoption of GNAP? Like, am I, without knowing it, interacting with it on a regular basis or not yet?
If you're doing your banking in Canada, you might be. But for the most part, the adoption that we've seen has been in kind of smaller silos and places that have kind of reached the edge of what OAuth really allows them to do. But they had more of a greenfield ability to decide how to address their problem set. If you're out on the wider internet, chances are you're going to be working with a bunch of OAuth-based systems, and so you need to be able to bridge between those anyway.
Right.
So there are a bunch of implementations out there, some of them public, a bunch of them proprietary, but it's not ubiquitous by any stretch, at least not yet.
Okay. Dimitri, I think you are on the queue.
So quick question, and apologies if it was covered before in an example. That previous access token slide, is there a provision for typing the access tokens?
So that's actually a great question. There's typing for the access tokens as far as the relationship between the resource server and the authorization server is concerned, because those are the parties that actually need to know about different token formats and things like that. The client, does not look into the content of the access token. It is an opaque, data object as far as the client software is concerned, just like it is in OAuth.
I see. And okay, got it. Thank you.
Yeah, but when the resource server gets an access token, it needs to know how to understand it.
Got it. But part of the reason I was asking is looking at the rich authorization request, it's pretty much isomorphic to both linked data authorization capabilities and UCANs. And so that's why I was wondering, using the type parameter, I could see how you could transport all three of those.
Yeah, you absolutely could. And GNAP as a protocol kind of doesn't care what the format of the token ultimately is. The relationship between the AS and RS does care sometimes. And so you could definitely carry, multiple abilities and multiple formats, in through the same system and apply them where it makes sense. Great question though. Thank you.
Any other questions? Harrison.
Yeah, Justin. I'm just curious because GNAP has so many improvements and so many ideas bundled into one. I'm just curious, is it worthwhile to, for example, earlier we have Mike Jones talking about demonstrating proof of possession. Right? Is it worthwhile to kind of have different components and different changes as opposed to bundling all these things into one big change? Just curious about your thoughts on that.
Well, a lot of the changes that we made with GNAP were foundational. Like I said, a bunch of pieces are being backported to OAuth, like the intent registration pattern you can see in pushed authorization requests. Unfortunately, because it's OAuth, you end up with something that, you start with something that's URL encoded and you end up with something that you have to put into a browser request. So it's not quite the same as the, grant request thing that GNAP gives you. Also from OpenID Foundation, we've got the grant management API and they've had to invent a bunch of, constructs in order to be able to have that work, grant identifiers and life cycles and all of this other stuff that OAuth doesn't really have. That's had to be added on and it needs to be understood by people doing that implementation. So for that case, you end up with a whole separate API that gets added on for just to solve that use case. With GNAP, it's fundamental to how GNAP works that you're managing grant access. And, so it doesn't need to be added on. Same with, like I mentioned, there's no client registration protocol. I serve as the editor of dynamic client registration for OAuth 2. We don't need it, in GNAP. So yes, you can add things to OAuth and people are doing that. But sometimes adding things makes the system a lot more fragile and a lot more complex to manage, than it does if you, just look at it in terms of, how would you solve all of these at once?
Got it. Thank you.
All right. Well, we are just about at time. So thank you so much, Justin, for coming and spending your time with us. This was really helpful and interesting. And thanks, everyone, for your questions and for being such a good community. And we will see you next week. Thanks.
Thank you all very much.